star, the axis of rotation of Earth, the accuracy by which you position the tripod on the ground is a big factor as such, unless you've got everything perfect. Even though the motor is trying to take out the Earth's rotation, let me drop it. The star of interest will slowly drift off the field of view of your eyepiece when you're at maximum magnification. So you've got to continuously monitor the thing. So here I am in the front yard, monitoring Sirius, and as the sun is rising, I wanted to keep my eyes dark adapted, so I put a great big black coat over my head. The neighbors must have think I'm a little bit crazy. Well, they know that ahead of time. So here's this guy, as high noon is approaching, with a black coat over his head, looking through a microscope, a telescope. And the bottom line is I watched Sirius all the way up to, I think, 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock in the morning. So you can see every star in broad daylight if your telescope has got high enough gain and it's aimed specifically at that star. By keeping that star in the middle of that extremely small field of view, when you're running the telescope at, I think I was running at 480 gain at the time. I was using a Barlow lens, a small eyepiece, small focal length eyepiece, and a 2,000 millimeter focal length main tube of the telescope. Put that all together, I think it comes up something like 480. And I did notice two things. One, the star Sirius in the daytime looked yellowish to me. At nighttime, it was bright white. In the daytime, with my eyes slightly adjusted for daytime conditions, it looked yellowish. And around 11 o'clock in the morning, I discontinued the process because Sirius started getting dim. I couldn't figure out why. As I looked out from beyond the telescope, I suddenly realized it was sweeping through the leaves of a tree. And so a little bit of light I was seeing from Sirius was being filtered through this very dense tree. And just a little bit of the light here and there was sneaking past those leaves as the wind blew. I've experienced that once before when I was looking at your repeater.
Time out.
Once before, I was looking at Jupiter as it swept through my tower, and I suddenly realized it got a little bit more dim. Another night, I was looking at Jupiter, and it got kind of dim. I suddenly realized it was becoming cloudy, and so my eyes said Jupiter wasn't there. The telescope was still showing it to me. So they're very good light-gathering buckets, if you know what I mean, a good large-time telescope. And that's just an 8-inch diameter telescope. This guy, John Vogt, who is... I think he's now the president or vice president of the Astronomical Society of Long Island, has this 33-inch diameter parabolic mirror that he ground twice. And when you look through that telescope, my goodness, can it gather light. Anybody have any further questions, comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That sounds like a good sculpt to me, Dick. I just have one of these inexpensive things. 70 millimeters. They're like 3 inches in diameter, just a refractor. But I mean, I had it out, what, three or four nights ago with this waxing gibbous moon thing, and you take a look at the moon, and you can really see the mountains, you can see the craters, you can see the shadows in the craters from the side of the crater. It's interesting. Just, you know, any kind of telescope is better than nothing. It's fascinating. Back to you, Dick.
Question, Dick. Yeah, John recognized poor old Galileo when he first looked through a telescope and he sees the mountains and valleys of the moon to realize it's a pockmarked, hilly thing. It's not a smooth orb. And by some means, he, I don't know how he protected his eye from damage. He looked at the sunspots on the sun. Boy, he got himself into a lot of trouble because the interpretation of the church at the time is that he was describing imperfections of the sun and the moon. And because that was a creation of the deity, they just couldn't accept the fact that it had imperfections. Therefore, he must be lying to them. He must be taking a false impression, a false interpretation of what he has seen. My guess is he tried to get them to look through the telescope, and my guess is they objected. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Oh, yeah, house arrest? They should have taken his head off. Blasphemy.
As you know, Dick, I did a few walks around the barrel, a couple of 8-inch lenses, and my question is, do you know how much that lens weighed, and do you know the thickness of that glass? Because these little 8-inch ones were quite thick, almost 2 inches thick. I wonder how thick that lens was, if you have that info. KC2WGB.
I believe John had made a special deal with Corning to make him a blank of that size with a whole bunch of honeycomb holes. In other words, they put a bunch of bricks in their molding device, which got removed later on. So this is a Dobsonian telescope. He's able to take it apart into pieces and put it into the van of his automobile. He's able to take it every year to, up to cellophane. I have seen photographs of it. I've seen photographs of him moving it. If I had to make a guess, I'm going to guess that that mirror is in the vicinity of 200-250 pounds, is my guess. But it's a heavily honeycombed thing. The good news is the honeycomb is lightening it. The bad news is that created some weakening. So the very first time he was grinding that mirror, a great big chunk of it broke off. So he had to do the whole process again. So next time I see John, I'm going to ask him. And if we go to Astronomical Society of Long Island, you see some of his pictures, I'll bet you there's a chance he gives you some of the specs on this Dobsonian telescope. When you're looking through the eyepiece of his telescope at a reasonable elevation, the eyepiece is in the vicinity of 10 feet off the ground. So you're standing on an A-frame stepladder to look through the eyepiece. Now, we all make jokes about the fact that after you look through the eyepiece of John's telescope, you have to take a parachute to come back down to the ground. But the fact that he's able to transport it, take it apart, transport it, and put it all back together, it's got to be less than 1,000 pounds. I'll bet you it's in the 200, 300 pound category, John. Over to you.
The Hubble is 1,800 pounds, the mirror deck.
Yeah, but that's not a honeycomb mirror. And I've forgotten, how many inches is Hubble?
I go by feet. It's an 8-foot diameter, though.
Okay, John is less than 3 feet. 3 feet versus 8 feet, and just area is a function of diameter squared. So, how many pounds again was the mirror in Hubble?
I remember because they ground this thing. It was a company in Connecticut that did it. They had the job across the pond from us. 1,800 pounds is what I recall, 1,800.
Yeah, that company's name is Perkin Elmer. Perkin Elmer, for a whole lot of decades, was a very respected optical house. And after the era of the Hubble Space Telescope mirror, they changed their name. So Perkin Elmer, I think, doesn't exist anymore. I think that's the name of the company. Does that sound familiar to you, Paul?
I've forgotten the name. No, that's gone out of my head a long time ago. But I know the company, I thought, went out of business. You're saying they just changed their name. They're like a submarine. They came up under a different name.
I think that's true, and I think there's a way we can check on that. Back to you, John.
You know, Dick, I'm wondering about the honeycomb, because you're saying he did that to lighten it. Are you sure he didn't honeycomb the front in very depth so that he could grind it easier? Because I know they do things like that, and it makes the grinding a lot quicker. So maybe he did both sides. Yeah, it'd be nice to find out.
You said honeycomb. These really big mirrors that are being built by the University of Arizona these days are done by spinning. If you take a mirror that's molten and you put it in a flat tray with edges to it and spin it at just the right rate, the material will form itself into a parabolic shape as it cools. And you're asking, did he do that to eliminate an awful lot of the glass he'd have to grind away? I'll have to ask him that question. But you only honeycomb it from the back. You can't honeycomb it from the front, because the front has got to be a smooth surface of a certain thickness before you start coming into the honeycombs. I do remember he had to do some very fancy things. Let me drop. I think he had to blow air at the back end of the mirror into those honeycomb holes at just the right rate to keep the glass at just the right temperature as he was doing the grinding, because the grinding is a heat-making process. The heat-making process expands the glass and creates an error, and you end up with bumps over the honeycombs, if you know what I mean. So I think he had to do very fancy control of temperature by blowing air into the honeycomb holes while doing the grinding. Now back to you, John. It was a huge project that went on for a couple of years.
Yeah, the spinning I've heard of, and it does give you a good start on the lens. Yeah, that would be a great thing to ask him, because I know the grinding of the 8-inch manually, I'm sure he was probably using machines to do his, but manually, besides the edge getting razor sharp, it did get quite warm, and you'd have to take a break once in a while, let it cool off. Sure. Good stuff.
And but boy, is that a telescope. And it's portable. It's got the box with a very fancy support structure, very elaborate support structure that holds onto the mirror. You've got these crisscross poles that go from the box toward the ring in the front, which holds the eyepiece. And then after you've installed all of that, there's a black shroud that wraps around those poles. So it's a very light, take a portable structure that he can ship into his we'd call it a suburban vehicle, a very large, it's more than a station wagon, his vehicle, but it's not quite a van. But by going to Astronomical Society of Long Island, you'll see pictures of that and him. Good group of guys that meet every single Wednesday night. I mean, most clubs will meet once a month. That group meets every single week. I've been doing that for the last 20 years that I know about. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yeah, that must be some sight to see. I've never seen a homemade one that large. That is a project. Wow. And I know that's not the only one he's ever built, so he's been a busy guy, that's for sure. But I guess the shroud that goes over it is like a photographer's cloth, something like that, something extremely light, snaps on maybe, and just actually has the mechanical framework that holds the sight tube and the mirror. So he has a couple of risers going up to that. So, sounds good.
Yeah, the total number of crisscross poles that go from the parabolic holding box up to the ring in the front that holds the eyepiece and also the 45 degree mirror. If I made a guess, it would be 10 poles that go up there. And the crisscross to be a rigid structure. And then, yes, it's a, call it photographic cloth that's wrapped around the whole thing and snapped in place so that you don't get light leakage. And anybody who's looked through his telescope says all kinds of good things. He brings it out to Custer Institute a couple times per year, brings it to a number of the ASLE conferences, and brings it almost every year up to Cellophane. And lots of people will Google over it, because when it comes to homebrew telescopes, I think there are very few that exceed 33 inches in diameter. Over to you, John, K2LAW.
Yeah, maybe I'll get a chance to get out there and take a look at something like that. At least on the webs, I'll take a look. But I don't know if Paul is finished with the space report. We sort of cut him off. Let's check with him. KC2WGB, back to you.
We're checking with Paul. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm done. John, I didn't have all that much. Not like last week. You know, but we could rehash the thousands of spacecraft that are up there, but we're not going to do that. Back to you there, Dick.
Okay, the third letter you had, John, was an antenna question, and I do associate myself with antennas from time to time. Over to you, John. Are you with us, John? KC2WGB? You're looking through your notes?
I thought the dog ate them. No, I didn't hear you turn it over to me. You want to broach that antenna question I have left?
Sure do.
I think from Roy. Okay. I have a young gentleman that has a 2-meter, 70-centimeter antenna array. Now, he's got it up about 30 feet. He runs between 30 and 50 watts. Okay. Now, he can get it up to 68 feet, but he will have to add another 200 feet of coax. How should he do that? What type of coax? And do you think it's worth the effort to do it? If he gets it up at 68, he has almost no obstructions around. At 30, he has a little bit. So what do you think his chances are? Dick, back to you, KC2WGP.
I did run a couple of experiments along those lines at my QTH. My trees in most directions are around 65 feet high. I've got a couple of 85-foot trees, but my average trees are 65 feet high. I had a Yagi at the side of my tower at the 70-foot level that cleared the trees in most directions on a sidearm of this 100-foot tower. And then I had the array of 16 Yagis at the top of the tower. And you can see the picture of that antenna at LimeRockTechNet.com. Mike number 2's website. And I had a way of switching the antenna so I could select one single Yagi at the top of that array of 16 Yagis at about the 105 or 110 foot level of the tower. So I could compare signal strength at the 110 foot level, let's call it 105, 105 foot level versus 70 feet. And I did that with guys to the west, to the northwest, to the north, to the northeast. The guys toward Boston, I would talk to a lot of times on 432. The guys down towards Philadelphia, the Mount Gary VHF Society, the Pack Rats, I would talk to them. And so I would aim these two antennas, exact same Yagi, two different altitudes. Most of the time, the higher Yagi was 10 decibels stronger on reception or transmission. Most of the time. Let me drop. So in my case, an extra 35 feet of altitude made a 10 decibel difference in signal strength. The only other guy I know who did a similar experiment is Dave Olean, K1WHS, the president of a company called Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine. And he did a series of experiments of changing the altitude of antennas and measuring signal strength. And he measured something fairly simple. What drove Dave and I to do that experiment was a statement that was published in, I think it was CQ Magazine, by Joe Reisert, W1JR. And Joe proposed that once your antenna clears the trees, to go any higher than that is a waste. You're just going to get more feed line loss. That was his belief. And he thought he had made some measurements to confirm that. But maybe it wasn't that carefully enough. Let me drop. So both Dave and I had some pretty strong feeling that extra altitude would buy you extra signal strength. That's the reason he and I both ran that kind of an experiment. So, if I had to compare what he's going to receive at 30 feet versus 68 feet on 432, it could be more than 10 decibels of signal strength. 10 decibels of signal strength, under some conditions, can double his range with Earth curvature and everything else going on. So, with that array of 16 Yagis on top of that 100-foot high antenna, to a well-equipped station, I could talk to him summer, winter, spring, and fall, most days of the week, 480 miles away. My radio horizon from the top of my little hill here in Huntington, on the top of my tower, my radio horizon is 40 miles away. I'm talking to somebody more than 12 times the distance to my radio horizon. I'm talking to people. When you put up the right kind of antenna, that you got that extra range, and you sweep a circle on the map around your QTH, let me drop. You rapidly see that you're encompassing a lot more area. The lot more area has a lot more people. The lot more people gives you a lot more guys you want to talk to. You'd be a little bit selective. I used to keep this card file of people that I've talked to on 432. And way back in, let me think now, 1980, by 1982 or so, I had QSO'd with 480 guys on 432 within that volume of the East Coast of the United States that I'm describing to you. And some of those guys, They all had a similar problem. There were very few commercial rigs, high power on 432 in those days, very few low noise amplifiers that you could buy. So of those 480 guys, I'll bet you there were 400 different solutions to the problem of putting up a good transmitter, receiver, antenna, tower, feed line, and whatever. And you pick the brains of each of those guys and you talk to them. And you find 400 different ways of doing it. In theory, after that database that I had way back then in 1982, I could have chosen the best of each of those and make a best station, if you know what I mean. But the nice thing about 432 in those days is that almost everybody there, let me drop, almost everybody there that you talk to some degree, had a reasonable amount of technical knowledge, had a passion, they're willing to make an investment of dollars, man-hour, hardware, and whatever, to assemble that station. So as you talk to these particular people, you're not talking to appliance operators, so to speak. You're talking to real hands, in the old definition of the word, where they homebrew an awful lot of their stuff. And they're building and using stuff that you can't buy in those days. So that makes them darn interesting to talk to. And some of those guys I talked to would be, one of them, for instance, would be Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, famous guy who wrote a whole lot of antenna articles. Another one was Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, again of Bell Laboratories, who is, in my mind, one of the primary inventors of the cell phone concept, starting in roughly 1968. He doesn't get much credit for it, but he did a lot of that early work. Interesting guy to talk to. And I still keep a conversation with him from time to time by email. He's retired to Georgia. Dr. Dick Turin is no longer with us. And if I go back in my card file, I'll probably find a significant number of other famous people that I talked to out of those 480 people. And not only did I talk to them, let me drop it. On these card files, I would keep track of how strong was their signal strength in microvolts at my house during that day. And so I could compare signal strengths of guys summer, winter, spring, and fall on 432. And quite a few of those guys would call me up saying, "Yeah, I just put up a new antenna. I just raised my antenna. How many microvolts am I giving you today?" And I would keep records of that. And so I could easily find the guys whose antennas would clear the trees. Their signal strength would be almost the same, summer, winter, spring, and fall. The guys whose antennas were lower than tree level, they were moderately loud in the wintertime. In the summertime, when you had foliage on the trees and right after a rain and those leaves are wet, the signal would sometimes be 20 decibels weaker because of foliage attenuation. So 432 and above, if at all possible, I think it's worth the investment to try to clear the trees. Now, when it comes to the extra altitude, is going to give you some extra feed lines. Let me drop. By hook or by crook, if you're a member of the microwave reflector group, the A1MBA, Whiskey Alpha 1 Mike Bravo Alpha .org, I think it is. You go to that website where he's got this listserv of about 400 people worldwide, serious microwave enthusiasts. And you pass the word on that group of people that I can't afford the $20 per foot or whatever it is for inches 5/8 Andrew Heliacs. Does anybody have a used piece of it in their backyard they're not using? There's a 50-50 chance you'll get an answer. And you'll be buying it at 5 cents on the dollar, if you know what I mean. You need a particular piece of hardware that is almost unobtainium, too pricey. And you mention to that group, and by way of enough conversations you have with them, by way of enough emails with them, and you go to enough of these microwave update conferences and whatever, and they suddenly recognize you as a serious guy, not just a collector of stuff, a serious guy that's really using it, a guy with a real passion, and you tell them, "I need a such and such, and I can't afford it," somebody in that group will find a way to getting it to you. In the worst case, you may have to pick it up with asbestos gloves, but you know what I mean. So my point of all this is that there are various ways of getting relatively low feed line at those frequencies. You don't have to spend a fortune. The CATV hardline, 3/4 inch, 7/8 inch hardline, is very low in loss. and almost ignore the fact that it's 70 ohm cable. It's a hell of a lot cheaper than anything you can afford, but it's extremely low in loss. And because it's hardline, it's made for direct burial. That's what you want to do. It'll survive direct burial for 20 years. Really rugged stuff. Put the connectors on the end of it properly. It's weatherproof, low in loss, high in power, cheap in price. Other than that, it's good. So don't let the feed line loss shock you into submission that you're not going to raise your antenna. If you've got the resources to put the antenna up higher, guarantee you will appreciate the fact that you've done it. You don't have to do it, you don't have to do it immediately, the first crack out of the box. Get on the air and start talking to people is the most important thing. Slowly improve the station after that. And as you talk to people and you find out techniques for improvement that are not costly but are high in performance, and you get the enthusiasm of talking to people and going to conferences and whatever. What am I trying to say now? No man is an island. The guys who are really high in microwave performance, for instance, are people who are continuously communicating with each other. They're not doing it in the dark all by themselves. They're doing it by sharing ideas. You see where I'm going on this one, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, very good, Dick. Now, I know that, like, LMR 400, you're looking at 4 dB per 100 foot. If he goes to LMR 600, he's looking at about 4 dB per 100 foot. So, with LMR 600, he's going down 8, possibly getting 10. So, airline would probably be his best bet. And if he could pick that up, like you say, from someone at a reasonable price, definitely worth the effort. I don't know. Do you think if he's only going to go for LMR 600, let's say, do you think it's worth the effort?
LMR 600 is a very good cable. If you insist on flexible cable and you're willing to pay the bucks, 7/8 inch, 3/4 inch or 7/8? 7/8 inch, 70 ohm hardline, CATV cable. You go to the right stocking yard where they use that stuff, you probably can get hundreds of feet of it essentially for nothing. Maybe you got to pay the guy a $20 bill as a nuisance charge. You're not really buying the stuff by the pound or by the foot. They got they buy it in 5,000 foot reels, and when there's 150 foot left on the end of the reel, or 250 feet, they put that reel back into the stockyard because they don't want to start another run down the block because they're going to have to put a splice in it, and the splice is unreliable. So the stockyards where they install cable TV cable, they've always got these reels left over, and you can get a hold of, by various means, you can get a hold of 3/4 inch and 7/8 inch I can't think of the brand name right now. It's not Amphenol, but anyhow, Comscope is one of the brand names that is popular. Foam-filled 70-ohm hardline. You can buy it for a song. Getting a connector on the end is a little bit difficult, but it's doable. You can do some home brewing, so to speak, to put the connector on the end. Let me drop. That cable runs something in the vicinity of 1.5 dB per 100 feet at 432. And I may be wrong, it may be 1.2 dB for the 7/8 inch and 1.5 dB for the 3/4 inch. You can't come close to that with anything else you're going to ordinarily buy other than air-filled Andrew Heliacs, which is $5 a foot. You're not going to do that. So CATV hardline. Ignore the fact that it's 70 ohms. Put a piece of paper tape on one side and write 50 ohms on it and make sure that side of the cable faces toward your transmitter. Your transmitter will never know the difference. But it's got numbers like 1.2 and 1.5 dB per 100 feet. It is lighter, stronger, better weatherproofed, cheaper, and overall it's good stuff. The only thing is that it's not flexible. So it's going to be the major run where at the top of the tower you're going to convert over to a couple of feet of flexible cable that goes around the rotator. And maybe as it goes through the hole in the house to come into the shack, another small piece of flexible cable. But the majority of the run should be hard line if you're a serious VHF, UHF operator. You can't beat the loss, you can't beat the cost, you can't beat the ruggedness. The only thing you can beat is that it's not flexible. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Bellevue coming.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, well, if he has a cable place like we do here on Staten Island that has reels and stuff, he may luck out. That would be excellent. And, yeah, I agree. I like the stuff. I've used it on occasion. And, reasonable. Even the connectors are available. A little bit of a pain in the butt to put on, but once you get the knack of it, it goes pretty quick, too. But, all right. So he's got a little project cut out for him. But I agree that if he uses that type of cable for that price, it's worth the effort to go up there, and he would probably pick up a minimum with the loss of the cable and all, maybe 6 dB at least. So I think it's worth a shot. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB. I believe Wesley had something to say, too.
Good evening, you're coming.
Yeah, go right ahead, Tim.
There is an article written by WHBYA. His weak signal operators at work in with the media scatter propagation. Anyways, he's got a very good article on how to terminate a 75 ohm hardline with you know, the stuff you can get from a hardware store. It's pretty cool stuff. You know, just use copper fittings and you know, a little bit of solder, and it's pretty neat. If you do a Google search on his call, W8BYA, and 75 ohm hardline, and you're going to find the PDF. Back to you, Dick.
That's one approach. I know of a slightly better approach, Tim, and that is the connectors that go on the end of the cable when they use it for cable TV, that connector is called a stinger. They call it a stinger because when the connector is installed in the end of the cable, you've got an outer thread that's 5/8 diameter, 24 threads for the inch, and you've got this long center conductor that goes into the weatherproof box through a weather seal, and that picks up the circuit inside for the amplifier for the cable TV. That stinger, with minor modification, once you install it on the end of the cable, the back end of a UG21 Type N male connector happens to have the exact same thread, 5/8, so it screws directly on. You cut that stinger to the right length and screw on the, and solder on the center conductor, and you've got a beautiful adaptation. And at first you're going to say, gee, I'm putting a 50-ohm connector on the end of a 70-ohm cable. But that whole connector assembly is only going to be an inch and a half long, and 432 megacycles, the wavelength is 27 inches. No matter what impedance you have in the middle of a cable, that's only an inch and a half long, which is what? 1/20th of a wavelength. It's going to have a very minor perturbation. You can study it on a Smith chart. You can study it with equations. It's a very minor perturbation. In fact, one of those articles that you'll find in the Mike Number 2 website, LimeRockTechNet.com, will describe to you exactly that phenomenon. Now, those connectors, the stinger connectors, are made to give you a beautiful collet fit, a really tight grab on the end of the cable, and a beautiful weather fit. So if you have to go to the Inexa Puzan company and buy those connectors at a few dollars a piece, it's worth it. But it's an even better approach. Let me drop. Your stockyard is where they collect all of the connectors that they've used once. They almost never use a connector a second time. If they're doing any service on the system and they remove one of those connectors on the end of the cable, they throw them into a bucket, and they all end up back at the stockyard, a great big pile of those connectors. They have them there in case times get really tough and the delivery, the after receipt of order time for buying connectors happens to be too long and they don't have any operating connectors. They'll dig into that bucket and clean those up and use them. So, again, you make a deal with the guy running the stockyard, you can get a number of those connectors, possibly for free. But then, even if you had to buy them outright, they're not very expensive. They're mass-produced in large numbers at a rather small price. So that connector on the end of the cable is made to give you an extremely tight bond, good weather seal, and proper impedance matching, so to speak. So to start off with, that connector on the end of the cable is worth doing. Now, cable TV companies are realizing, let me drop, that typically they have to put something like 14 amplifiers per mile to continuously keep boosting that signal which is being lost in their cable. As such, in the old days, they used to use a lot of 3/4-inch cable. Pretty soon, they started using a whole lot of 7/8-inch diameter cable. Now, they're mostly using 1.2-inch diameter cable. If you manage to get your whole hands on some 70-ohm 1.2-inch diameter cable, I'll bet you it's approaching 9/10 of a dB per 100 feet at 432. It's lighter, stronger, cheaper, quite a bit better. When it comes to insertion loss, for that diameter, for that length, for that frequency, it's essentially state-of-the-art. Any further comments on this one, Tim? KD2AVU, K2RIW.
To exchange next.
Thanks, Dick. No further questions on this, but I'll just make sure I keep my eyes out for these cables. I've seen them being used even in China, you know, when I was there visiting my family, and I saw some CATV cable TV guys were running cables there, and I saw the cable. So I was so tempted, but anyways, back to you, Dick. K2RW, KD2AVU.
Yeah, so starting to say they're trying to eliminate the loss as best they can because it allows them to put in less amplifiers, and there's a lot of money in those amplifiers. John, over to you for a final, and then pass it over to Wes. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I think he's got a project, and if he can get some of that cable, and it's a lot of work, 200 feet of that cable, but I'm sure he'll enjoy the benefits of it. Okay, let me turn it over to Wes, KC2WGB. Over to you, Wes.
Thank you very much, guys. Roy, AC2GS. I should call him Secret Science Agent. Amazing brain. As a matter of fact, everything the best for you, my friend, because of our holidays. Anyhow, he brought my attention to new discovery. It's not a new discovery. It's 1.5 years old, but it's something interesting. One might think of matter and antimatter as mortal enemies, since the equivalent particles, such protons and antiprotons, normally destroy each other on the contact, which I have seen a few times in my lab. However, there is more in it. There was a guy in Terry's, and his name was Ettore Majorana, and he predict presence of matter and antimatter at the same time, and that was puzzling enough for me to look in it. So now I'm gonna quickly read some of the article. The new Majorana particle showed up inside a superconductor, a material in which free movement of electrons allows electricity to flow without resistance. There was a guy named Ali Yazdani of Princeton University. He placed a long chain of iron atoms, which are magnetic, on the top of the superconductor made of lead. Normally, magnetism disrupts superconductors, which depend on lack of magnetic fields, for their electrons to flow unimpeded. But in this case, the magnetic chain turned into a special type of superconductor in which electrons next to one another in the chain coordinated their spins to simultaneously satisfy the requirement of magnetism and superconductivity. Each of those pairs can be thought as an electron and anti-electron, with negative and positive charge respectively. And that arrangement, however, leaves one electron at each end of the chain without neighboring pair, which causes them to take on the properties of both electrons and anti-electrons, which would be the positron. In other words, it's a proven presence of Majorana particles. Enter Jean.
Wes, in the beginning of your conversation, you said protons and antiprotons, when they come together, they annihilate each other. And you have experienced that. I am very curious, where were you standing when you experienced that, Wes? Go ahead.
Well, that was not in the environment of Majorana particles. Actually, when you have a positron that is hitting orbital electron, you have a 180 degrees, two photons that are spreading fast in opposite direction. So when you put your sodium iodide with thallium or your high purity germanium detector right at the right angle, you are able to see the presence of this particle. At the same time, if you put another one from the other side, you are able to see the presence of it. And it's the confirmation of the collision. That's also the confirmation of the presence of antiparticles, which is the positron. Enter Jean.
Okay, are you saying that this took place in your laboratory or some of the laboratory that you visited, where protons and antiprotons were being created and allowed to combine and annihilate each other? That's what I think I heard you saying in the beginning, Wes. Go ahead.
Well, iodine, I believe it is iodine. I got to check with my sources. Iodine 122 is a great source of electron inhalation. I have a set of the sources traceable to the bureau, which are either beta particles, radiators, or gamma particle radiators, and so on. So, when you have a situation in which, from inside of the nucleus, you are having a transmission of a protons, at that point, you can expect that the collision with the orbital electron happens. And there is nothing special. It's nothing that is a difficult. I remember you were using a word which is, it's a device that allows you to precisely set the angle of incident. Forget the name, English name for it. So you can set your detector exactly and then turn around and see if you have any response. In other words, There is a program that is created by Ordrick, but also is another one created by Canberra. And this program allows you to have incidence or coincidence, which actually is a comparison between two signals. And when you see those two signals, you know for sure that this collision happened. Yeah, this happened in my lab, and that's it.
Okay, so protons and antiprotons, if I understand correctly, were being created by a reaction that you had created in your laboratory, and the annihilation of them was being detected. Has anyone ever expressed any doubt as to whether or not that was the exact reaction taking place? And that was the exact result. Has anyone ever expressed any doubt on that one? Because to create protons and antiprotons, the CERN accelerator does that with great difficulty. They have made some antiparticles, and they were able to hold on to them for, I think, a sixth of a second is their record so far before they crashed into the side of the cage. So they would lead you to believe that making those is very difficult, is what they would lead you to believe. And so, if you did it in your laboratory in Queens, it sounds like it's awfully unusual, is what it sounds like, Wes. speaking to XJN, K2LAW.
You're mixing the facts. It's not a proton, antiproton. It's a positron. Positron is a beta minus. It's a positive, it's antiparticle to the electron. Positron, not proton, and to XJN.
Okay, I may have heard you wrong. I thought I heard you say proton and antiproton. So, electron and positron. And so, by what means can you make positrons? How can you generate positrons in a laboratory in Queens? What's required to do that?
In order to create a particle that is antiparticle and particle, all you need is just to have a source that are capable of doing it. I'm trying to get to that right now, particular a piece of paper that I have had. I'm going to find it and give you exact information about it. Hold on.
Yeah, many of us have had a PET scan. In fact, I've had a PET scan. Positron emission tomography. So by starting off with a nuclear source that they had injected into my body, and by using this scintillation-like detector that slowly walked around my body and eventually drew a three-dimensional picture, the PET scan was scanning positron emission tomography. And so I guess if you start off with the right nuclear source, it is automatically emitting positrons. Is that approximately what's happening over the U.S.?
Looking for this paper, when I had that, it was from that experiment that I was having. The positron is the antiparticle that is created in the nucleus, in the isotope that is capable of creating that particular antiparticle. And then electron, just the electrons are just the orbital body, and those two collide with each other. And PET scan is exactly what I'm describing here. The beginning of the PET scan was where I have this paper. The beginning of the PET scan was actually because scientists were able to observe those particles and the collision that is happening, because you have a two photo. Enter again.
Yeah, I should have asked these questions when these diagnostic tests were being done on me 6 years ago. I'm getting the impression that the right nuclear material that has the right isotopes in it that can be injected into a human being emit positrons. I am guessing those positrons, when they hit the scintillation counter, create a flash of light, and that flash of light has a certain direction of arrival that's being measured. And right now I'm having a little bit of trouble of understanding how the positrons from the substance in the bloodstream of my body, how do those positrons go through my body without being annihilated, and didn't get annihilated until they got into the scintillation counter external to my body. How did they avoid being converted when they hit my body? How did they avoid the cells of my body but didn't avoid the scintillation counter? I'm guessing we're talking about percentages here. Maybe only a small percentage escaped from my body and got into the scintillation counter. Is that approximately what happens? 2XJN, K2LIW.
1YDY with a comment.
W1YDY, start off with your name, sir, and then tell us how that works.
N1YDY, my name is Hank. We've spoken before, Dick, and it relates to the speed with which certain organelles of your body absorb or uptake the fluid that has the positrons in it. When you get a PET scan, what they're looking for when they're specifically looking for things like cancer is they see an uptake in glucose, and this glucose is actually a method by When I say uptake, the uptake is the speed with which it is absorbed into the cells, and it is the method and the timing with which it is absorbed into the cells which cause the positrons to annihilate with electrons at that time. And one whitey white.
Yeah, Hank, I can see how... I can see how that, depending on certain diseases, I might... stand by a minute. I can see how certain diseases I might have, certain portions of my body are going to absorb that material. So there's a concentration of that material in certain portions, and that's what they're imaging. But now the emission of that material that has been uptaken by that organ of my body, how is that positron getting past all of the tissue of my body and getting into that scintillation counter? I presume the positron becomes annihilated in the scintillation counter, gives you a flash of light, and that's what the detector is recording. But how did that particle get through all the tissue of my body in the first place? Or maybe my body absorbs 30% of them, and maybe 10% of them get absorbed by the detector, and it's enough to make an image? Is that approximately what's going on? N1YDY, K2RIW. Okay, so the cancerous material is going to be absorbing nutrients a hell of a lot faster. It's got more angiogenesis and whatever, and so it's going to create a concentration of the material. But if I understand you correctly, Hank, what you're saying is that there's ratios of tissue absorption of the emission versus the detector, scintillation detector absorption. So I guess a certain percentage of those emitted particles in that concentrated organ of my body allows the material to pass through the tissue and get into the detector. And so my body doesn't absorb them all, the detector doesn't absorb them all, but there's enough of a ratio in both cases to make an image out of it. Is that approximately what's happening here, Hank? N1YDY, K2RIW.
No problem. I just think that might be, I was going to be in your neck of the woods, and Again, I know sometimes you get misleading and stuff, but I wasn't sure if you were calling, that's all. That's correct. November, I'll be taking the week in France, the week in Ireland. Pretty much compatible with what we have here. Not much different temperature-wise and stuff, so if anything, it might be a little bit more moderate. I don't know if it gets quite wild between the weekend, but yeah, it won't be beach weather, but it doesn't mean that the scenery won't be nice. You can enjoy the culture and the food. So hopefully they'll both be enjoyable. I'm going to be really good, I know that. My wife is going to exist on, I think, croissants and I don't know what she's going to be drinking. I know they ate sushi. I don't know if they imported, but a lot of places don't get good prime steaks here. Great, very different place, you know, there. But we'll work out, I'm sure. It's not going to be that much time. There's a man who exists on something, so my daughter's really, really having a good time. Blending in quite well, enjoying everything, doing a lot of sightseeing, and everything's going well. It's going to be a culture shock for her to come back home. Yeah, but I might have to slip it to her without telling her just what it is. Because the idea of it was going to be like, nope, we got a butcher shop by us that sells buffalo and American-made fine stuff. But I didn't get her to try that. I'm going to have to get in one night and ask if she can prove it or not. I didn't have to like that. So, the much darker meat than the meat, side by side, the same taste and have the same cut, you can really compare it. So see how it looks different. It does have a little bit of different flavor, and I was trying to ask a question. Well, if somebody didn't realize it or thought they would eat meat, the people would do it, they probably would, but not know how it's prepared. And that's true. I do like that sushi, so it's a good food. I just enjoy it, it's like, no, just as long as I can eat it. But I've been missing out on a lot of good stuff. But, oh well. We'll be good, that's for sure. Going to be bringing a little USB radio with me, and an operating condom for both places as well. Both W, I think, although I might try some digital. The radio will be GSK. I know that's going to be pretty good, very low power. So I'll try a little bit of both of those, I think, going on there. I've spoken to a bunch of people in France. I don't think I've spoken to anybody in Ireland yet, though. Heard them on like Echo Link, but haven't made HF contacts with them. I've seen quite a few in France on CW. But yeah, we'll see how that goes. I'll make sure I can have the right paperwork before I leave. And go with that. I'm just going to bring my minimalist package. I'm going to go with the batteries that are in the radio. Cord to recharge it if I'm on that long, and the wire antennas and said wire antennas. I don't even need coax. I can just run the bare wire right up to the radio. I have a body post in the install. You know, it's really lightweight. Not much space. That's true. And I'm not going to be calling the lead. Talk to some person to find out, but as far as I can tell by looking at our website, they are both functioning full of it. I'll be guided into it. France on the F-QRP. But I guess QRP as well, but it'll be a little bit long to send, but I guess it'll come through one way or the other. There are certain countries that you do have to apply, I guess, through the embassy first and get the authorization. Very few countries make you get a call sign there unless you're going to be there for a certain amount of time. But most of the time, that is required. But France and Ireland are not like that, are they?